Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, this frigid Sunday, December 21st, 2008. Today we're going to be taking on one of the biggest issues in our nation that gets virtually no attention in the media whatsoever. That is a central concern in media areas of media activists, but even there does not get the attention I think it warrants. Today we're going to be talking about advertising and marketing to children, commercialism in children, an absolute boom industry over the past two decades. And we're going to be fortunate enough to have as our guest one of the truly outstanding experts on the subject, Juliet Shore, an economist from Boston College. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy the show with me today. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Last week, National Public Radio announced plans to cut 7% of its workforce and cancel two national shows. Reporters, editors, researchers, and production staff will be among the 64 people losing their jobs. The cuts are designed to close a $23 million shortfall in the current fiscal year. The two canceled shows are Day to Day, which is targeted to a younger audience, and News and Notes, a show that explores issues from an African-American perspective. Interim President Dennis Harsager said that neither program was attracting sufficient levels of audience or national underwriting. News and Notes was started to fill a gap in NPR programming targeted toward the Black community. Richard Prince is a columnist for the Maynard Institute, an organization that trains journalists of color and helps the news media reflect the nation's diversity in staffing, content, and business operations.
NPR in general is not a major player in the African-American community, and this was one of the efforts to redress that.
Prince says that although it may not have gotten the ratings of some of the more popular NPR programs, News and Notes has been important for its perspective.
Part of the attraction of a show like News and Notes being on NPR is that people of all races could listen and learn and discuss. And that's the kind of thing that we desperately need right now. And so that's one of the niches that it filled.
Another cut was NPR's Next Generation program to recruit journalists of color.
This gets close to the whole issue of diversity, internal diversity, as well as diversity of programming. Doug Mitchell had started a program called Next Generation Radio, in which he would go to the various journalists of color conventions and later the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association conventions and work with young people to attract them into radio.
Many of these young people have gone on to radio jobs at public radio stations around the country.
Part of the purpose for diversity and for diverse programming is not necessarily just to serve those particular groups, but to expose one group to another so that we can have a wider conversation.
And now, a special commentary by Free Press program manager Josh Stearns.
The year 2003 holds a special place within the history of the media reform movement. That was the year when nearly 3 million people rose up against media consolidation. In the end, the Senate and the courts struck down the FCC's attempt to gut media ownership limits. It was a watershed moment that introduced many new people to the politics and policies behind our media system. While 2003 was a moment of crisis that catalyzed a movement, 2008 has been a year of movement building that proved to lawmakers and corporate lobbyists that media reform is a nationally recognized issue that is still gaining momentum. Over the past year, I've had the good fortune to work with organizations and individuals in nearly every state and have been consistently awed and inspired by their care, commitment, and creativity in the fight for media reform. This year provided a number of stark reminders about why we do the work we do. When the FCC tried again to gut the long-standing newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban last December, public interest groups promised a swift response, and within weeks, more than 250,000 people had written the Senate and demanded they take action. On May 15th, the Senate voted to overturn the FCC's rules. The bill didn't get all the way to the president's desk, but the new rules are still in the courts, and any new merger deals are likely dead on arrival. In late April, the New York Times revealed how the mainstream media bought into a Pentagon program that coached pundits to sell the war in Iraq. While independent and community media sources reported on the scandal, the mainstream media remained largely silent on the issue. But tens of thousands of activists sparked an official investigation and renewed efforts to cut off funding for covert propaganda. Then, in September, the country watched in shock as St. Paul police abused and arrested journalists trying to cover the Republican National Convention and the protests outside their gates. Within 3 days, more than 60,000 people had taken action, and local citizens hand-delivered their letters to St. Paul City Hall. In response, all charges were dropped and the journalists were freed. These three brief examples are just snapshots of a movement that can't be summed up by individual actions as much as its forward momentum. The election of Barack Obama, a longtime supporter of media reform, does not mean our work is done. Indeed, it is now more important than ever to translate our short-term successes into a long-term vision for better media for America.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, December 21st, 2008, on a day that is frigid across the Midwest and to the East. A good day for being inside and thinking about the great issues of our times here on National Public Radio. And we're very fortunate today to be talking about an issue near and dear to my heart, one I've been working on as a scholar and one I've been concerned with as a citizen for many years. And it's a good time to talk about it, too, because there's a brand new video that has just come out by the Media Education Foundation on the topic. It's called Consuming Kids, the Commercialization of Childhood. It is 67 minutes long. It's aimed for high school and college classes around the country. I've watched it. I think it's one of the finest videos I've ever seen on any subject, a documentary, but certainly on this subject. And it features a number of the real experts on the issues of advertising and marketing to children and their effects, including Susan Lynn, David Walsh, Josh Golan, Alan Kanner, Gary Ruskin. The list goes on and on, but none, in my view, more valuable than today's guest in our program, economist Juliet Shore, who is a professor of sociology at Boston College, author of many books, including, most pertinent to today's discussion, Born to Buy, which we had her on the program to discuss a few years ago, and I still consider one of the really classics in media studies. Juliet Shore, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you.
It's really an honor to have you here, and I must tell you, I don't know what role precisely you played in the documentary Consuming Kids, but it's an exceptional piece of work. It covers more ground in 67 minutes than I would have thought possible.
Thank you. Well, I helped them formulate it and passed on a lot of material and, of course, was interviewed. And they put a lot of work into it.
Yeah, it shows. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, and I have children and I'm interested in media, and I know you have children, you're interested in media. So for us, this isn't really shocking to learn this material. We're sort of familiar with the terrain. But I'm still struck when I talk to people, even people with children, but especially people without kids, how unaware they are of the phenomenal transformation that has taken place in the realm of marketing and advertising to children over the course of their lifetimes or our lifetimes. And maybe you could just start our discussion today, Juliet Shore, by just talking about what the level of marketing and advertising is to children today and how that compares to, say, 40 years ago.
There's been a dramatic increase in both the dollars which are directed at kids. We don't have hard numbers on this, but when I began researching this topic, which was 1999, the number I was coming up with for total advertising and marketing dollars was about $1 billion, maybe $2 billion if you sort of thought of it in a very expanded way. Now we're talking about $15-16 billion a year. So very big increase in quantity. Many more products being advertised. I mean, that's one difference. Advertising and marketing taking place across many different venues or sort of media and non-media outlets. I think one of the things that adults feel is, oh, you know, we had cartoons back in the day when I was a kid. And, of course, there were we had commercials back in the day. You know, since the 50s, you've had television for children and specifically child-directed advertising. And there's a tendency sometimes among adults to think that there's nothing new going on here. It's just, Yeah, there's a bit more of it, but it's sort of fundamentally the same enterprise that they experienced, and they're fine. It didn't unduly influence them. It didn't harm them, and therefore, there may be a few more advertisements around today, but it's they think of advertising to children as something they're already familiar with, and I think that's part of the lack of awareness, or part of the mistake sometimes that some adults make when they're thinking about what's going on today.
You know, I was watching the video Consuming Kids. They had a few clips of the commercials from the 50s, 60s, and 70s that were aimed at children. And it is an extraordinary thing to juxtapose those to the sort of advertisements my 13-year-old daughter has been watching for the last 5 years. It is like the difference between a horse and buggy and a rocket ship. The nature of the advertisements, the sophistication of them, the audiovisual onslaught of them.
Right. Now, in my study of what was going on in the industry, one thing became very clear. In those earlier decades, marketing to children was very much a backwater in advertising industry. There were very few dollars committed to marketing to kids, which meant there really wasn't research that was done. People put together these commercials kind of by the seat of their pants. They were very formulaic. They tended, the people who were in it tended to be people who had kids. They used their own kids as, you know, to kind of try ideas out on. So it was a very, very low budget sort of much less effectual kind of enterprise. And many of the people who did it were sort of they were people who loved kids, and that's why they were in that part of the industry, or they just weren't creative enough, and they weren't sort of the hotshots who would get the better jobs. And that changed dramatically. And it's all been driven by the fact that children in the old days commanded very little purchasing power. They got small allowances, and they didn't drive parental purchases. And what began to happen as family incomes rose, as parenting styles changed, and kids got much more influential within the families, and as the sort of time use of the household changed, and we can get into that, but was that children began to have much more influence on parents' purchases, and also to have a lot more money of their own. And in advertising, money follows money. So as the kids' market started growing and really began taking off, especially in the 1990s, a lot of money went in there. And so it became one of the hottest areas of advertising. And everything got much, much more sophisticated. Lots of dollars to research, lots of dollars for production, lots of dollars to get really smart people, lots of dollars to expand into new areas. So it upscaled. Its effectivity upscaled, as well as its just sheer magnitude grew.
It certainly is now no longer in the backwater. It's in the hotshot zone of the Madison Avenue sector and the corporate sector at this point in time.
Right, and that's partly because you have a lot of the adult markets which are, you know, reaching kind of a saturation where, you know, if you're advertising beer, well, that is actually also advertised to kids sort of covertly and surreptitiously,
yeah.
But cars, beer, some of these, you know, so-called mature markets, the effectiveness of a dollar is a lot less because people are more locked into their brands. There's just not a lot of same kind of growth in those markets. The kids market and pharmaceuticals, actually, those are the two really go-go, high-growth areas for advertising. I think the industry would have really had to retrench a lot and scale back dramatically at least a decade ago, if it weren't for those two sources.
Children and pharmaceuticals?
children of pharmaceuticals. It's a kind of ugly picture.
Yeah, it really isn't a good picture. Our guest today on Media Matters is Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, author of many books, many award-winning books, most pertinent to today's discussion, Born to Buy, which was published a few years ago, which I used very successfully in my classes here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about advertising and marketing to children and its effects, its history, and where it's at today, and what we can do about it. And part of the reason we're doing that is to take notice of the new documentary, which has just come out, Consuming Kids, the Commercialization of Childhood, produced by the Media Education Foundation, and a truly extraordinary piece of work. And for anyone interested in the subject, I urge you to check out the Media Education Foundation online, learn how you can get a copy of this documentary to view yourself and to show to your friends, family, students, what have you. Our phone number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Please call in with questions or comments, if you wish, for Juliet Shore. And, you know, a little more background I'd like to do, Professor Shore, before we get more into the nitty-gritty of what's going on today and the implications, is the importance of this as a policy issue. It's not purely an issue of free markets operating as they will, but there was actually a significant debate in the Carter administration era, the late 1970s, over whether even to permit advertising to children. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. There were two big dimensions of this debate. One was whether it was fair to advertise to kids, or whether there was something inherently manipulative and exploitative about it, on the grounds that children couldn't both understand advertising depending on their age, or as they got a little bit older and could differentiate between programs and ads, whether they possessed the cognitive capability to resist the persuasive power of advertising. Now, by children, we're talking about the age range up to about 12 years old, and the literature there was a lot of research done back in the 1970s for the government to ask this question, and the research was fairly consistent in saying, you know, below the age of five, kids have trouble differentiating between ads and programs, so they don't even really understand what ads are, and really up until the age of 12, it's hard for them to resist the persuasive power of advertising and to really understand ads as a persuasive form of communication. The idea that what the advertiser is trying to do is get you to buy something. So that was one issue. The second one had to do with the advertising of sugared foods. Mm-hmm. And there was a strong view in the Federal Trade Commission that sugared foods shouldn't be advertised to kids. Now, this is important because the advertising of sugared foods and now also salty and other kinds of junk foods is a very large proportion of total ads. I think at that time probably more than 50%. Now it looks like it's about 40% of the ads going to kids are for these, you know, sugary or junk foods of one form or another. So those were the two debates. And what happened was that when the Reagan administration came in, Congress shut down the ability of the FTC to involve itself in rulemaking related to children, because they were about to put in, most likely, some rules on these two issues.
You know, I can remember when I was a TV junkie growing up in the late 50s and especially in the early and middle 60s. And I was 10 or 11 when I found out that the advertisers actually paid for them. I thought they were part of the programming. And, you know, and the ads were very unsophisticated then. I could only imagine what a kid would think today, where the ads are so much, the production quality is so much higher than they were back in my day. Our guest again today, Professor Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, author of the book Born to Buy, and one of the experts on the video we're talking about today, Consuming Kids, the Commercialization of childhood. Our phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today. We'd love to have you join us. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Yes, thanks for discussing this. It seems to me that one of the greatest effects that's affected our children and is concerned with the advertising is the amount of hours that kids are spending on TV. In other words, it's the growth of TV and commercial TV. So you're all putting it in, before there were children watching hours a day or many hours a day watching TV, there was no access to these children. And I'd just like you to comment about that. It can go much farther, I think.
Yeah, and before you do answer that, Juliet, sure, let me just add for the sake of those who haven't had the privilege of seeing Consuming Kids that there's actually a fairly lengthy discussion in there of precisely this phenomenon of the, you know, how childhood has changed from my generation, certainly, and I suspect from yours, from where we basically had unregulated play outdoors commonly through much of the year, unless it was really cold or wet, to one where that's almost disappeared.
Yeah, and that's I have some data in my book about that. There's very low hours per week of unorganized outdoor activity by kids, by organized, of course, talking mostly about sports. Less true in the sort of rural and suburban areas, but, of course, a big change in those places as well. And in urban areas, kids don't have safe spaces to be outside playing. Now, the issue about the growth of hours, media hours, and the access to kids is an important one, and it begins to really expand in the 1980s. Prior to that, the numbers of hours of dedicated children's programming were relatively low. They were Saturday and Sunday mornings and then some after-school hours, and in the 80s you get the development of cable channels for children, Nickelodeon being the most famous. Of course, you have Disney and other children's cable where they can do a lot more advertising. But you know what's interesting also that's happened is that as children and youth more generally have become a much bigger target of advertisers, and there are also ways in which primetime advertising is oriented to children as well, because not all of it, but advertisers know that kids are no longer just watching children's television. At younger and younger ages, they're watching adult-oriented television, whether it's sport programming or shows like American Idol or even dramatic shows.
Or Tyra Banks or Oprah Winfrey.
Right. So kids are there in the adult, you know, the what is officially thought of as adult programming space too. And I think this is really important as we think about the policy dimensions of this, because the debate about children has been almost virtually confined to what is officially children's advertising. So that's advertising on these children's shows and channels and so forth. But if you really want effective regulation around what children see in the way of advertising, you're also going to have to be looking at all of that programming that they watch that is categorized as adult.
You know, one of the things, Juliet Shore, that you write about in your book and that they talk about in Consuming Kids is, you know, the themes that are in these advertisements. You know, advertising to kids is not that advertising adults is by any stretch, but advertising to kids is not about the attributes of products and price comparison, the sort of stuff economists tell you that information consumers need to make purchases, but it deals with extraneous themes altogether. And it also has what you've described and what's been described as the nag factor. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, the content of these ads and what sort of values it's communicating to children?
One of the things I found is, and argued in my book, is that there's been a very important shift in the nature of the advertising to children from, as you say, what I called functional characteristics kind of advertising. So the commercials of the 50s, 60s, and 70s were about how the products worked. Toys are the famous example because they were, the companies were, you know, hauled into court because they showed toys doing things that they couldn't do. And this is another another thing that today's adults think the problem of children's advertising is that it's deceptive in this way. So it promises what it can't deliver in terms of product attributes. And in fact, that's no longer really much of an issue because the message now is, so I say it's gone from what I would call functional to symbolic advertising, which is also the way a lot of products are advertised to adults. But that is that the appeal of the product is pushed in terms of what it says about the purchaser. So if you buy the Nike shoe, you will be cool, or if you will be happy, or you will get friends, or you will be freed from the oppression of your parents or your teachers. Or so it's about emotional and symbolic states. And we can talk about food in a minute because it's, I think, particularly pernicious in the case of food, but it's problematic all across the board. So that's been a huge shift, and it's much more insidious because it strikes at the basic sense of self-esteem, because what the commercial is saying is you need the product to be okay. It used to be you need the product to have fun.
Yeah.
Kids could see they could have fun anyway. You need the product to be okay, like, oh, am I okay if I don't have the UGG boots that everybody has? Am I okay if I don't have the iPod when everyone else has it? There's that basic sense of self that is attacked in some fundamental way by this whole edifice. Now, it's often very subtle. They you know, they wouldn't be allowed to go on TV with ads which directly said that. They can't say, you need Nike to be cool. But kids get the message. They understand the message.
It's pretty hard to miss the message if you watch the visuals.
Yeah. Nag factor is the idea that you go and ask your parents to buy the product. So that gets to that kids in what they call kidfluence, kids influence on parental and grandparental purchasing. And again, they're not allowed to be too explicit about it, so they have to do it in fairly subtle ways. But
it works. I can vouch from experience.
I've done some through my organization. I co-founded the Center for New American Dream. We did a really fun poll on nagging. Kids nagging their parents and ask them, you know, how many times they nag for the thing that they want that their parent doesn't want to get them, and what's the, you know, what's the number of times at which finally the parent gives in, and so forth.
Our guest today is Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, author of the great book Born to Buy on advertising and marketing to children, and one of the featured experts on the brand new documentary by the Media Education Foundation called Consuming Kids, The Commercialization of Childhood. Phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a lot of ground to cover. We're just getting started, but let's go back to the phone lines right now. First, let's go to line two, Urbana. You're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You were talking earlier about kids being able to distinguish between advertising and the programming, but the truth of the matter is that nowadays that distinction has really barely exists anymore. Every product, you know, I have young children, every product that they see an advertising for, they want, ends up having, you know, characters and plot line and short shows. And we just recently got something for my son. It came with a CD with little stories, and of course introduces more characters that he wants to buy. And of course it's all the case that every show and movie has product tie-ins, but it goes both ways now, and it's really there almost is no distinction.
Yes, and this is very important. It's another example of why the approach that was developed back in the 1970s and early 80s to these issues. So, for example, program separators, where the government did require in children's programming that there be a kind of break between the program and the ad. You know, that's just a quaint, ineffective device at this point. The other dimension of it is that programming itself is now increasingly product-inflected and product-driven, with the growth of product placements and storylines around products and so forth. Advertising as an industry is in a crisis because it's sort of canonical, you know, its core vehicle, the 30-second television ad, is thought to be increasingly a relic because people can TiVo them out and so forth. So they're desperately searching for other ways to get their message across, and what that means is that an already blurry line between ads and programming is collapsing pretty rapidly. So we are into a, you know, what they talk about a 360 branding world, but increasingly, and especially you see it more with kids, it is that world in which brand messages are basically incorporated into so many spheres of their lives, so many places, whether it's their schools, when you go to the museum or the zoo, of course, all of the media space, internet games, you name it. Church, religious institutions increasingly are targets of marketers where they're starting to put brand information in books, et cetera.
You know, Juliet, sure, one of the chilling scenes in this movie in Consuming Kids came when they were interviewing a psychologist, Alan Kanner, and he was talking about how he's been working with children for a few decades, and that until, you know, from the, in the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s, whenever he'd ask kids what they wanted to do when they grow up, he'd hear the traditional range of professions, policeman, fireman, astronaut, nurse, teacher, what have you. And they'd have clips of the Art Linkletter show from the 60s with kids giving answers like that, postman, things like that. And he said, starting in the late 80s, and not coincidentally, the period after this explosion in youth advertising, the answer almost uniformly became, I just want to be rich. I mean, it's just that was. Are you still there, Juliet?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, I think we've got a line there. Okay, I think they grabbed it. But it was a striking, you know, sort of statement on sort of the morals and values and ethics that are being communicated to our kids in our advertising, and it struck with me. And I'd like you to talk about that. But one other thing I want to get to that I think comes through in your work and in this documentary, which doesn't get talked about enough either, is that these gender roles that are portrayed in this advertising that are perpetrated, that are played upon, are, it seems, you know, for one who grew up in the feminist era of the feminist revolution of the 70s, it seems like if the people in the 70s who led the revolution and knew we'd be where we're today, they'd think they didn't win anything.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, when I went for my book, I was able to gain entree into some of the New York big advertising firms, some of the major firms, and I used that then to sort of parlay myself into some of the smaller firms. So I kind of was able to get the range, and I was a sort of fly on the wall. I got to sit in on client meetings, and I had a lot of presentations and just hung out with, I shadowed a marketer, I went to focus groups and so forth. There was, on your second point, the point about gender, there was a sense of incredible throwback to the kinds of things that they were saying. I mean, I felt like I was back in the 60s or the 50s. Most of them articulated a really traditional gender bifurcation kind of thing. And they really think in terms of very traditional gender roles in the way they see children and the way they market to them. So they have all these sort of rules that they follow. For example, Girls can be enticed to buy boy products, but not the reverse. So typically, when you do a commercial, you put more boys than girls. Girls always have to have sort of the feminine dimension to it. The sop to feminism is girl power. So that goes along with you have to be sexually appealing, but also powerful. So that's the kind of, you know, that's the extent to which they've moved. Every product has a gender analysis done for it, even food products, which is interesting, and they decide how they're going to skew them. But so the girls get a small fraction of the products. The dominant decision will be boy products, meaning products that are specifically sort of real boy things, and anything that sort of has a more neutral coding to it will be have a boy advertising. And the themes that boys are thought to care about are things like mastery, ambition, intellectual dimensions, you know, creativity. Those things are all categorized as boy attributes. Girls get, you know, maternal instinct, sexuality, and a specific girl power. So absolutely. There was a little bit of talk about what's called gender blending, where they're starting to see some crossing over of some of those lines. But yes, they're very behind the times when it comes to gender roles.
We have I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I did want to say something about your first point on what kids want. And I found the same thing both in looking at national survey data and also my own survey data. I did a survey of so-called tweens, so 10 to 13-year-old boys and girls. And the thing that jumped off the page in terms of the highest numbers of kids strongly agreeing in my, you know, in the surveys was I want to be rich. And but I think the one thing to remember about this, and this is true about a lot of the developments in children's culture, is that they are mimicking or following what's going on in adult culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important not, because that's what happened in the culture at large, is over this period, is a glorification of wealth. And so there are ways in which children's culture is unique, and there are other ways in which the trends that we're seeing there are just very much of a piece with the general social and economic trends.
Our guest, Dr. Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, author of the book Born to Buy, one of the experts in the new video Consuming Kids that we've been talking about, put up by the Media Education Foundation. We have a full bank of callers, and I tell you, I've got so many questions I'd like to ask. I like to hog you, but that's not how it works here at Media Matters. We share you with our listeners. So let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Farina, welcome to the air. You're on with Juliet Shore.
Hi. Oh, where is Professor McChesney? I've never heard of this author, and this topic is so important. Thank you. Thank you once again for introducing myself and everybody to this author. You did mention pharmaceuticals, the push to load kids up with pharmaceuticals. My biggest gripe with the general culture is the anti-intellectual thing where scientists are not, and intellectualism itself is not treated in a heroic way, and then also, could you comment on McDonald's? And thank you so much. And thank you, Professor McChesney, for this program.
Thank you very much for the kind words. Juliet Shore?
Well, intellectualism has certainly been a casualty of American culture, particularly in the last 8 years. And you can figure out what 8 years correspond to. It's become part of the culture wars. I'm a little bit optimistic now. You know, we have a kind of an egghead president coming in, and hopefully he will diffuse some of the sort of the cultural exaggeration around, you know, kind of effete intellectuals as somehow people who are against ordinary people, and that kind of culture war that really, I mean, it's since Nixon, but really got accentuated during the Republican administration of the last 8 years. So that's the first point. The second one about McDonald's is interesting. You know, if you think about a couple of years ago, McDonald's was really in trouble. It had been attacked by Eric Schlosser with Fast Food Nation, and then you had the Morgan Spurlock Supersize Me. Domestic operations of McDonald's were doing very poorly. It was a kind of flailing company that didn't have its act together and was in danger of being sort of losing brand value. And they've been very smart in recent years in reorienting their advertising. And if you look at what they did, they became very hip. And they came up with that "I'm loving it" slogan. Their advertising appealed very much to young people. They got a kind of cool mojo back to what they were doing. And now, of course, they're very well positioned because of economic hardship to do well. Mm-hmm. Having gotten their cool back, now they can advertise with their low prices. And I just heard a really smart McDonald's ad yesterday on the radio. So I think that skewing toward young people, not through the Happy Meal strategy, which is the little ones, but through these sort of tweens and adolescents and young adults, was very intelligent on their part, and, you know, unfortunate, I think, because in the end they remain a junk food company that's selling really unhealthy food to people.
You know, as I read your book, Professor Shore, and as I've taught it, and as I've was watching this documentary, Consuming Kids Today, before the program, you know, it seems to me that the effects of all this marketing and advertising on our children and on young people have what, as you know, economists love to call externalities, tremendous negative implications that aren't borne by the people who are participating in the market directly necessarily down the road. And I couldn't help but thinking, you know, what sort of world are we going to have 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road if these trends continue at their current pace? And are we seeing the effects of this already in college-age kids? Are you noticing this with the kids you're teaching at Boston College?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, certainly the kids I teach today are much more oriented toward material goods and shopping and so forth than college kids of earlier generations. They're much more consumers. They watch television at college. They spend a lot more of their time involved in consumer culture. And in some ways, I think that's at the expense of being interested in sort of ideas and intellectual discussion and politics and so forth, the kinds of things that were you know, probably more popular, at least among certain groups, back in the 70s and, you know, maybe even in the 80s as a sort of residual impact from the big political movements of the 60s and 70s. On the other hand, I think the current situation, you know, with the collapse of the economy and the collapse of a culture of greed and the questioning of a consumer-driven economy that's going on now, which I think is going to grow, is going to also have its effects on how children are raised.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of, you know, the sort of commercialization of childhood that this film talks about and that my book talks about and the others have been writing about of the last few years, it's in some ways the late stage of this consumer boom. And as that boom has turned into a bust and you get cultural and political and other kinds of revaluations of what's been going on, I do think we're also going to start to have people question how they raise their kids. Certainly issues around the value of money are going to change because we're going to move out of this debt-driven consumer debt-driven economy, and people are going to feel more of a need to teach their kids some other values.
Our guest today, Dr. Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, author of the book Born to Buy, and also one of the participating experts in the new film Consuming Kids, The Commercialization of Childhood. We've got a couple of callers who have been waiting very patiently. Let's get back to the phone lines right now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. It's my understanding that corporations will hire professionals from the field of psychology to help them with their advertising and marketing. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. To me, it seems somewhat unethical. I mean, the psychologists are basically giving advice on how to reach kids. And if you could talk about that a little bit, I don't know if it's covered in the movie or not, but I appreciate it. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And I should add that there's quite a bit on that in the film Consuming Kids, as well as you've written about it, too, in Born to Buy.
Yeah, there's been a move by the advertisers to get professionals from across the social sciences, so psychologists, but also anthropologists, sociologists, and There was a resolution within the American Psychological Association to try and have this kind of behavior deemed unethical, and the task for, and a task force and study, and some of the people in the film were leaders in that effort and involved in that. They didn't end up going that far. I think that there's really mixed views about this. People in the industry claim that they are doing good things for kids. So for the most part, except for some of the worst junk food, they don't concede the point of view that they are evil and manipulative. They say they are bringing communications to kids, that kids are savvy and understand, that you can't fool kids, and that by advertising directly to kids, they're treating them in the same way that they treat adults, and that's somehow empowering to them. Now, obviously, other people have a different point of view, and I think they're, you know, my own point of view is that there are actually ways in which both sides have a point on this. The idea that somehow only adults should get persuasive communication or advertising is a little problematic to me. I mean, I do think that kids are more, that the gap between adults and kids is less than the ads or manipulation point of view would have it. On the other hand, I think that we also have underestimated the extent to which adults can be manipulated by advertising. So I think we need to understand that whole process better. It's a lot more complicated than the research, I think, has yet really spelled out. But I had one marketer who was really interesting. She was probably one of the most intellectual and smartest of the people I talked to. She had a PhD in linguistics and anthropology from the University of Chicago, and she told me she refused to do advertising on kids because she felt it was exploitative and manipulative, the kind of point you're raising. And I had a lot of sympathy with that. She said, on the other hand, I'll try and sell anything to an adult. I have no qualms about that. So there are people who draw the line there. People draw that line in lots of different ways. My own view is that almost no advertising is really very worthwhile, and from an economist's point of view, it's a big efficiency or a welfare loss for the economy as a whole, because I don't think people get much out of advertising.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to yet another patient caller. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Dr. Juliet Shore.
Yes, good afternoon, Professor Shore. I had a chance to talk briefly with Sat Jolly on the question of the proletarianization of children consumers of advertising, and he has this theory that by consuming advertising, you actually become a worker, in the sense that what you're making is a consumer. So it's kind of, I don't know where you stand on that, but if in fact Saat Jolly is correct in this, then it would seem that National Public Television's children's programming during the days is a perfect example of that. And how insidious, in your opinion, is that programming? And even if that programming is insidious, children's literature is also suspect. So I'll let you go. Thank you for taking my question.
Well, yeah. Thank you very much, caller.
It's a very interesting point of view, and I think there's a lot to it. The French theorist Jean Baudrillard made this point about consumers as a whole some decades ago. You know, back in the 60s, he said consumers have been turned into the productive forces. You know, what Marx talked about is the forces of production. We're the productive forces. This idea that consuming is what keeps the system going, and kids are just the next frontier in that. I think that's there's a very important insight in that. There's another way in which kids have been proletarianized that I write about in my book, which is that they are hired as little advertisers by these firms to do research, to promote products. There are hundreds of thousands of kids out there who are, I mean, some companies claim millions, who are involved in these word-of-mouth product networks where they get hooked into companies, and in exchange for free products or other perks, they basically tout, covertly tout products to their friends. So they're also being drawn in as proletarians or workers in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the public TV has a great big halo, which is undeserved at this point in many ways, because it's, you know, although the forms of advertising that are going on with public TV are somewhat different, I mean, less different now than they were, obviously, in the past. A lot of the impacts, I think, are similar to commercial TV. Again, that's a line that's blurring. And I think, in many ways, the big problems associated with TV is just, or one of the big problems is how much people are watching. So it's not only what they're seeing. What I found in my research was the more kids watch, the more they become involved in consumer culture and kind of psychically colonized by consumer culture, whatever they're watching.
Well, Julie, sure. We have time for one more phone call, and we've got a special call now from Line 2 in Urbana. Hello, you're on the air with Julie Shore, our guest.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Just a second.
Don't be shy. I think we have a young caller here.
We do.
We'd love to hear from you.
What can a kid do to not be tricked?
Oh, that's
by advertisers.
What should a kid do to not be tricked?
Thank you very much for the call.
So the first thing you can do is to watch some ads with some other people, maybe some other kids and some adults, and if you can tape them or TiVo them, and go back and study carefully what's going on in those ads. Try and figure out why did they use the music they did, or why do the characters say what they do, why are they dressed, what's happening. So one thing is to, you know, we call it deconstruct, but kind of analyze or figure out what's going on in the ads. That's one way. But I'll tell you, and I say this as a mother of two children who grew up basically with no television watching at all and very limited other kinds of media watching, the best way to avoid being tricked is to not expose yourself. So the less exposure you have to these commercials and programs, the freer you will be and the more able you will be to kind of determine your own path and figure out who you really are and what you want and what makes you happy. And that, I would say, would be the number one thing that I would advise.
You know, Julie, sure, that's a common bit of advice and certainly good advice to give parents and to give kids. But, you know, is the as you've made, pointed out in your own work, and as Consuming Kids makes very clear in the documentary, that's part of the answer, but it's also a political question. There also has to be, parents can't do it on their own. They need a little bit of help on this. What sort of policy solutions are there to the problem of advertising and marketing to children that we should be looking toward?
Yes. I mean, good point you raise. And, you know, I was talking to the caller with that advice. So that was sort of what an individual can do.
Yeah.
I think we need to start, number one, rolling back the levels of advertising. So more public funding of programming, taxes on advertising, regulations on the kinds of products that can be advertising. For example, I think we should have a ban on all food advertising. We haven't talked too much about food, but it's a hugely important part of this. I think the idea that food choices are driven by marketers is appalling. I mean, it's really problematic. What we eat is so fundamental to our health and to the healthy reproduction of our society that to allow individual profit considerations of firms to drive that seems really socially dysfunctional. So I'd say, you know, number one, if I could wave a magic wand and get anything, that would be the first thing I'd be asking for.
And what's number two? I like your list so far. Let's keep going.
Number two would probably be a tax on advertisements on children's programming, which would then, the revenues from those could go into a fund for the creation of programming. And one thing I called for in my book was a new media entity, a kids media entity, which was actually for kids and substantially run by kids, publicly funded. So a new, you know, would be a television channel and an internet presence and probably, you know, magazine and so forth. But I really feel it's important for kids to be able to create their own media products and media experiences to, rather than just the sort of more paternalistic thing we have where it's adults who create for children. So I would love to see a kid-driven media institution developed and grow in this country.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, Professor Shore. Just wondering if you could recommend groups that people might want to look up on the Internet or elsewhere if they want to learn more about this issue?
Sure. There are a number of wonderful groups. There's the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, CCFC. There's a group called Dads and Daughters, which specifically deals with issues of media and girls. There's Commercial Alert, which I am on the board of, which has done a lot to work on the commercialization of childhood. There's a group called Obligation Inc., which has been fighting Channel One, which is a commercial television broadcast mostly in public schools around the country.
I think in that note, Dr. Shore, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you on our show.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
All right. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I want to thank Colleen Cook, my producer, who sat in for Andrew Boyle this week. And I'll join you again in 167 hours. Have a great holiday week, everyone.